So I'll start off by chanting the four vowels. Anyone that knows it is welcome to join in.
Shigur Segan Mo On Shujo
So this evening, I'm going to speak about the three poisons, as they're known, and the Buddha's teaching on them, and how that applies in the lives that we lead. That's what I want to speak about. So basically, the three poisons comes from an idea that, from the Buddha, a key aspect of the Buddha's teachings and Buddhism is that the drives within us manifest and cause us suffering. That's effectively what it is, that there are impulses in us which drive us to act in life, to interact with other people, to try to make things happen, etc. And even though those impulses are part of human nature, they're a fundamental part of human nature and part of what it means to be alive, nonetheless, they cause us suffering, particularly when we become puppets for them. And so part of the practice of the Buddha is to become aware of these and to let these go. And I've used the phrase the three poisons to describe them, which is a very commonly used phrase in Mahayana Buddhism. And if you see the wheel of existence, the diagram of the wheel of existence, about the traditional cycle of rebirth, reincarnation, we've got one on our wall out there. You'll see in the middle, there are, at the very centre, the thing that drives the wheel of existence, you can see three little creatures. And if I remember rightly, it's a snake, a rooster, and a boar. And those three little creatures, which are going round in the middle, represent the three poisons, and it is them which drives the cycle, the wheel of existence, which drives us to impel us to act and to suffer and to act again and to suffer and to act again and to suffer. And part of Buddha, part of the Buddha's teachings, the ultimate aspect of Buddha's teachings, is to give us the insight to lift us out of that cycle of suffering. But the Buddha didn't actually use the phrase the three poisons. He didn't use that expression to describe them, which I find interesting. It's something that appears in Mahayana Buddhism. He used a different phrase. He called them the three fires rather than poisons in the fire sutra. And he actually used a number of different ways of talking about these deep fundamental impulses which drive us to act in the world. At different times in his teachings. And the first phrase he used, which actually is in the Four Noble Truths, he used the phrase thirst, the thirst for life, to a certain extent. It's the thirst for life which drives us to act, to engage with life, and as a result, to suffer. And then he, in the Fire Sutra, he spoke about the three fires. And in other sutras, and other Buddhist teachers use different categorizations. So the three poisons and the three fires is one possible categorization of these drives. And another word for them is klesha, which in Japanese translates to bono, and that is one of the things that we've just chanted. The second line of the four vowels is bono, mujin, seganda, the endless drives within us. I vow to overcome them. And so so it's part of the four vows in a way. But the three fires is one of the images that the Buddha used to describe them, and it's one that has an important, it played an important role in Buddhist teachings because it's become the three poisons in Mahayana. And so, as I say, they're drivers to action. They are things that impel us to move forwards in life, to push us into forwards life. But in particular, they tend to drive us to unskillful action because we become puppets to them. They drive us to unskillful action, action which disturbs the mind of ourselves and of others, of those around us. It causes suffering of ourselves and of others, and it causes disharmony in the community and society. That's what these three fires do. And so, as I say, there's many ways of categorizing these, but the three fires, in some ways, is the most primal way of categorizing them. And it says that all these different drives that we experience can be boiled down to emerging from three things. And those three things are craving, aversion, and delusion. Those are the three fires: craving, aversion, and delusion. Craving, which is known in Sanskrit as lobha or raga, aversion, which is dvesha, and delusion, which is moha or avidya. And so these are the ideas that the Buddha expressed in his teaching of the Fire Sutra and have become a part of Buddhism ever since. Craving means effectively the grasping of those things which are in some way attractive to us. And that is, as I say, all these are drives to life, and in some ways, at a certain level, these things are necessary to live. But nonetheless, they are necessary to live, but also they're a source of suffering. So the drive to move towards those things which are attractive to us are what will make us reach for food, that kind of thing. So it's necessary to live. If you're going to, so the fact that we feel hungry and say, "Okay, I want that piece of food," then it is necessary in life. But nonetheless, and so there are many. So that's kind of quite a basic one, food. But it manifests in all kinds of other ways: the craving for beauty, for love, for being looked up to. There's many different things, and for different each one of us, it will manifest in different ways. So it's not that it all manifests in the same way. But nonetheless, there are some things which draw us, and we get pulled towards them. And these things become poisons when they become so strong that we can't resist. We become puppets to them, consciously or unconsciously. We might not even know that we are puppets to these things, but they pull us. So craving is one of them. The next one is aversion. And aversion is often translated as anger, but I don't think that's a very good translation. Anger is part of aversion. If there's something that we don't like, basically what aversion is, the desire to remove or get away from those things that we don't like. That's what aversion is. And so part of that is anger, in that if something emerges that you don't like, then one way of responding to it is to get angry about it, to get angry with it if it's a person, to get angry about it. If something happens, an interaction with a person that isn't going the way you want, and anger emerges and you shout at them. That's one example of the way that dvesha, aversion, manifests. But the reason why I think anger isn't really the best translation of dvesha is because aversion does not always manifest as anger. It manifests in different people in different ways. And for me, personally, it tends to manifest more often as fear. It's the desire to avoid a situation, to run away from something I don't like, rather than necessarily getting angry with it. And so I think that... But aversion is a primitive... So whether someone gets angry or afraid, takes avoidance action, or goes in with all fists blazing, aversion is the fundamental force which we can be puppet to, which again is useful because, as I've said before, you want to avoid standing in front of a bus that's coming trundling down Gloucester Road at speed. So it's something that keeps you alive, but if you become puppets to this, if it becomes so intense in your life, whether it's conscious or unconscious, or intense in a single moment, then it will cause suffering for you and for those around you. So that's aversion. The next one is delusion, to not see things clearly. And from the point of view of the Buddha, the key delusion in the Fire Sutra, he uses the expression, is I-making, as in I, and my-making, me making. So I making and my making. So the fundamental delusion from a Buddhist point of view is taking yourself too seriously. And effectively what that means is our self, from a Buddhist perspective, our self is constructed. Our self has no fundamental, intrinsic, independent reality. Our self is constructed through causes and conditions of all things, the interactions that this self has with those things around it. It's defined in that way. It's not something that has some unique independent existence. This is a key aspect of Buddhism, which puts it at odds with some other traditions, including Hinduism. That was kind of the differentiation that the Buddha made compared with what the Vedic people were saying. So this self that is constructed, the key for Buddha, the key delusion is to take this self too seriously, to take our ego too seriously. And part of that is engaging in activities. So the way it manifests itself is engaging in in activities which reinforce the self, which make one look good in front of others, that kind of thing, to create a personality, to create an image which is maybe beyond the reality. We all do it to some extent, and I think one of the key things that the Buddha says effectively is that these things are operating in all of us at all times, and part of our job is to see it. So we all create a certain image of ourselves. We all try to feel okay about ourselves, and there's nothing wrong with trying to feel okay about yourself, but nonetheless that is an act of self-construction. In a little bit, if you're leading a lay life as opposed to a monastic life, a little bit is appropriate to live. As one of the ancient Zen teachers said, before you can go beyond the ego, you must have an ego. So if your ego is just, you know, I'm so bad sort of thing, that's not so good either. So you need to have a little bit of these things to hold yourself together. But we mustn't take it too seriously. We mustn't take the desires and wants that we have too seriously. We mustn't let them turn into craving. We mustn't take the dislikes that we have too seriously. We mustn't let them turn into aversion, anger, fear, etc. We mustn't take our desire to create an image, a desire to the things that our ego wants to project and impel in the world. So part of that is, in fact, our opinions. Part of our constructed self is the opinions we have. In the end of the day, those opinions are just a result of the causes and conditions which have created this self. They don't have any intrinsic value beyond what this self gives them. And so the fact that this self wants to impose it on you and convince you that I'm right is simply an act of ego. And so our opinions as well are things that we can let go of. It doesn't mean that we don't, nonetheless, in relative worlds, act. If we have a view about something, maybe it's right to try to make it happen. But we shouldn't take it too seriously. And by not taking it too seriously, it actually means that one can have more harmonious relationships. So these are traps, effectively. These are traps. When they dominate us, they stop us being free, and it means that we are... So the strange thing about in Buddhism, the idea of free is quite different from, if you say, like the idea of free in Western capitalism. In Western capitalism, you are free to express your ego however you choose to. In Buddhism, we strive to be free from our ego, because our ego is what we are puppets to. And so the art of working with the three fires is to become free from the ego, as opposed to the ego being free to do what it wants, which means one needs a little bit of gentle discipline in one's life. So that's the three poisons, the three fires. And from a Zen point of view, following the Buddha, we believe that through the practice of simply sitting, letting go, then we can become aware of the way in which these fires operate in our lives. We can become more aware of them, particularly when they're more extreme and we're unconscious of them. And we can let them go. That's the key part of the Zen practice. It's not saying, oh, that's really bad what I've just done there, I must stop doing it. It's just noticing it and letting it go. And noticing it and letting it go. Noticing it and letting it go. And then from a Zen point of view, what that does is naturally, unconsciously, and automatically transforms it into something else. It disempowers it. We're no longer puppets to it. And so the act of sitting regularly holds a mirror up to one's own mind. We see the stupid things that our minds do more clearly. And we all, you know, even the coolest looking person or the most successful looking person, their mind does stupid things. And in the end, our mind, you know, the most successful of us, our mind creates, our ego creates a socially acceptable and successful image in life. But nonetheless, there's all kinds of crap going on in there, nonetheless, no matter how successful someone is. As you know, because it happens in your mind too. So don't think that your mind is any different from anyone else's, you know. There's all kinds of crap going on in here. And some of it escapes, some of it doesn't. And so the art of Zen practice is to see that and to let it go, to see it and let it go. And that means at least the silly things that happen inside us don't necessarily spill out into the world and cause suffering for ourselves and for others. So it's holding a mirror up to the mind. The other thing about Zen practice, which I've spoken about before, is that for us and for the Buddha as well, Sangha, community, is very important, because simply doing this on one's own, one will become aware to a certain extent, but people around one, people around you, make you aware. And so I didn't realise this, but there's a thing in Japan. The thing in Japan is that these various Zen masters, they got catchphrases, you know, like used to be popular in 1970s television. And different Zen masters, they have their catchphrase, which kind of summarises their teaching in a few words. And I was given a T-shirt by a guy who used to be the head of the International Zen Association, of the catchphrase of his master, and it was "Encounters make us." And so it's got "Encounters make us," and it's got a little Japanese thing on the side which says "Encounters make us." And my wife was convinced it was some kind of sales thing for something like Nike or something like that when she first saw it. But it's not. But "Encounters make us," and because part of his teaching, which I think really goes back to the Buddha, and this is to do with Sangha, is that it is our interactions with other people which make us aware of the ways in which these fires, the mistakes that we make, are reflected back to us by other people, by our interactions with others and their responses. And so that's a key part of our practice, is to being aware of what goes on in our interactions with others. And the Sangha is important, because the Sangha is being together with other people who have also made that commitment. You see what I mean? So one can do it with any person, but being with someone in the Sangha means that someone else has also made that commitment, and therefore there will be more awareness and respect, ideally, for what's going on in that relationship. What's going on in that relationship? Ideally, I say, you know, we all make mistakes. But nonetheless, it also applies to relationships with everybody. Relationships with one's boss, with one's partner, if they're not practicing, with one's friends. You know, these are all opportunities for awareness. And when I say this, I don't mean in a kind of po-faced way where you're kind of separating yourselves off from the others by being too, I suppose, being too obvious about what you're doing. But allowing yourself to be aware in your interactions with others of the ways in which these fires express themselves in your relationships with others, and taking care. So we've moved from individual practice to Sangha and now to the broader community. And now I want to look now at broader society. And what's interesting about these fires is the Buddha effectively was an early psychologist. And nowadays our psychologists have got even more sophisticated maybe than the Buddha. And we've got technology, etc. So these fires, the thing about these fires are they are very powerful. They are what drive us to act. These fires are what drive us to act, for better or for worse. And not only do they drive us to act, we can be swept up by them, which means that they control us. And so one of the most effective ways of influencing others, for better or for worse, is by using these. It's not a Buddhist way, just to be clear. It's not a Buddhist way, but it's nonetheless one of the most effective ways of influencing people quickly, is to make the three fires arise in some way. One of the reasons it's not a Buddhist way is because even if you want to bring out the best in someone, if you might use these things to make them do something which actually is good for them, but they're very unpredictable. These fires burn hot. They're very unpredictable. They're uncontrollable. And one doesn't know what damage they're going to do over the extended period. So as I say, it's not a Buddhist way, because it disempowers the person. It makes them a puppet. But nonetheless, because they're powerful, they're used very often in society. They have always, throughout history, they will have been used. It's not a new thing. They're at play in human relationships. They're in play in group dynamics. If you're in the office or wherever, you know, workplace, they will be at play there. They're at play, of course, in politics as well. And the thing about nowadays is that they are harnessed more and more effectively and consciously and professionally by people. And that's something that, in some ways, is part of our practice. It should be part of our practice. And the art of advertising is a very good example of that. If you look at adverts around the place, you will see very often they are trying to trigger one or more of the three fires. So desire, very common in adverts. You will trigger whether it's a nice-looking ice cream that you want, or a beautiful young man or woman associated with a piece of food or something. There's often things that are designed to trigger desire. Less often, but nonetheless quite common, more subtle in some ways, is fear. The fear of not fitting in, so I spent a lot of money. When fear comes in most, I'm not sure if any of you got young children, maybe a few of you have, but fear comes in most when you've got a young child and you want to do everything to make sure this young child is all right. And there was this amazing advert, and I'm just amazed that I bought into them. My wife just really took the piss out of me for this. But basically, they were selling this kind of language things for about three-year-olds that I bought, and my kid just didn't like them at all. He's 19 now. He didn't like them at all. But basically, the way they were advertised was effectively, I'm going to paraphrase, but do you want your child to be a retard? If not, then buy this. It was it was really unsubtle when I look back at what it was. It was really kind of pushing the buttons of the parents. And that is the time when, I think, particularly for new parents, that's one of the times when the buttons are pushed most often of fear. You also find it in things like insurance sales and that sort of thing. But fear, and the other thing I think, which is again more subtle, is identity making. You often find adverts sell using image. So that is about the I making and my making. Do you want to be like this person, this cool person who also happens to chew Wrigley's spearmint gum, or this sophisticated executive who buys mobile phones for his wife or whatever? You know, there's all these things which where there is an image which for some people will be an idealized version of how they want to see themselves, and therefore they will buy into this, etc. So advertising is really a technology that uses Buddha's three fires to try to make us do what the advertisers want us to do. And of course, politics as well. Anger is one that plays a great part in politics, as one can see very obviously, and more obviously nowadays, maybe than it used to be. And also identity making, the desire that you to be part of a particular group. And this has always happened, but now what's happening is that it's harder for us to escape it. And one of the reasons why it's harder for us to escape it is these things, you know, digital technology. These consciously constructed triggers are being pushed at us more and more pervasively. That's the key thing. See, so more and more pervasively, which means mental vigilance is more and more difficult and needed. That's the thing, because it's become more and more pervasive, these things. And so it's harder to take some time out from it. And the other thing is that modern technology and media exaggerates it. It's a hyper-reality. You know, we are what is projected to us. Ever since maybe the 60s or 70s, through the television sets beginning, and now more and more so, is a hyper-real version of how things actually are. We see the most beautiful people, and they're even more beautiful than they actually are in real life, because their blemishes have been touched up by Photoshop, you know, this kind of thing. And so there's a hyper-reality. These things are being pushed at us more and more skillfully and more more and more exaggerated and more constantly. And so even though these forces have always been with us, it is the practice now is harder. And one of those practices is actually, to some extent, to there's two ways to do it. Either, and we had a Dutch woman who is a Tibetan nun who was ordained by the Dalai Lama, staying with us in our house. She was the friend of my wife Ilse's, and she was staying with us a couple of weeks ago. And she, because her vows include things like not hearing music, that's one of the things that she has to do as part of her vows, because she's made a number of vows. And of course, my daughter was playing music, and she said, "What I have to do is mentally just switch off." The nun was saying that you learn to have the discipline to kind of just try to dissociate yourselves from what's going on around you. So even though music is there, her practice is partly not to hear it, not to get pulled into it, etc. So these things. So that's one option. One option is to have the mental discipline to, even though these things are being bombarded at you, to be able to have the presence of mind to distance oneself from them. And that's not easy. The other option is to try to hide from them. And one of the ways to hide from them is to come here. You know, at least, yeah. So there's no advertising on the wall. Well, no, there's the seven principles of Dogen Zen back there, but that's about it. So one way, or to go to a temple, etc., you know, to kind of distance oneself from life. But also one can do that to some extent by making decisions, by using a certain amount of discipline, rather than saying, I will avoid being drawn by these things, by creating environments where you, at least for some time, are not pulled by them. So, for example, distancing yourself from a smartphone for a bit, turning the internet connection off on the computer, that sort of thing. Because I find, for example, on the computer, I could be doing something, and then things will just come in through my inbox. The latest thing from Avaaz or something. Get really angry about what the government's doing, and feel really angry, and then feel better by clicking here. That sort of thing. You know, so they're using it as well. Might be something I agree with, but nonetheless, they are using the three poisons to make me do what they want me to do. And so I want to at least shut that off for a bit. I want to shut that email feed off for a bit. So be aware of how these things are being used and be more conscious of them, because they used to be used more or less unconsciously, and we would, you know, kind of... Now they're being used far more deliberately and systematically. And so our practice becomes harder, but more worthwhile. So I think I'll stop there. We will finish by chanting once more.
Shigu Segan Mohon Shujo Muhen Segan Do Bono Mujin Segan Dan Homo